and welcome. I'm Mark Winkworth, and you're listening to Tales of the Sea. Today we're going to talk about champagne wishes and caviar dreams. For those of you who might remember the late 80s TV show, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, with Robin Leach, you'll recognize that catchphrase.
And I'm Robin Leach with those champagne wishes and caviar dreams.
Well, we're not going to be talking about champagne today. All the focus in this podcast will be on caviar. Salted, processed fish eggs, or roe. The kind that can truly be called caviar because it comes from various species of the anadromous fish more commonly known as sturgeon. As early as the 9th century, the joys of eating caviar were on record. Over the centuries, this nutrient-rich food was famously served by Russian czars, Middle Eastern shahs, and many other royalty, but also eaten by the common folk. That is, until scarcity and price took it out of their reach. Joining me on this journey is George Fazen, a market associate and caviar specialist at Brown Trading Company, the premier provider of fine caviar. Brown Trading Company is located right here in Portland, Maine. George has over 12 years of experience in aquaculture and has become an expert in sustainable seafood. Let's take a look at the source of these tasty fish eggs, how they're harvested, why they're so appreciated, and why the real good stuff is so expensive, and why caviar dreams signify images of decadence and great luxury. George, how cool is it to go to work every day where part of your job is to taste caviar?
Well, you know, I have to say that there's a reason I do it. And one is it's really important to not only me as someone selling the caviar to taste it regularly and see how each batch is, but it's really important to have the customers taste it as well. There's a lot of fraud in caviar, and you can't just go off of the tin or off of the name. You got to let people taste it. That's just another way of proving your trustworthiness as a vendor.
That's a great way to look at it.
A lot of times, the perception of caviar is what it's been for a very long time, which is that it is a delicacy only for the royal class or the noble class or the wealthiest elites in your society. And it's that way because of its taste, its presentation, and the rituals made around caviar have made it that way. It's kind of the opposite of fancy cheese experience, which is, if you think about fancy cheese, it's pungent, it's stinky, it's intimidating, and a lot of people find it kind of gross. And, you know, only the artisanal, sophisticated people like it. Well, with caviar, it's kind of the opposite. There are a lot of imitation products out there from other fish that are not sturgeons, like paddlefish or spoonbill or bowfin. They're cousins of sturgeons, but they're definitely not sturgeons. And that's the stuff that's really readily available and is cheap, and people will market it as caviar. And when they taste it, it is really salty. It is really fishy. Some people have said it tastes like a gym sock that was left in your bag for the weekend. And I wouldn't go that far, but I see what they're saying. It's pungent. Where the real stuff, the nicer, high-grade, true caviar, is the opposite. It is easy to eat. It is not funky. And it is really buttery and delicious. So that's how it all started. That's why people wanted it, is because it's delicious.
Man, good for you.
Definitely good for you.
Okay, bottom line, what is so darn special about sturgeon roe?
What sturgeon roe is it is baby formula for baby sturgeons. Mammals take good care of their fish for a long time up until they're juveniles. Fish don't do that. Most fish, you know, they only have 6 months to live because everything in the ocean is trying to eat them, like sardines or those bait fish where they're, you know, welcome to the world. You better reproduce as soon as possible because all those fish over there are going to try to eat you. So they don't really have a lot of time or energy to invest in their eggs. It's kind of like, all right, you know, spawn your eggs. Good luck. But sturgeons are not that way. Sturgeons have evolved to live long lives. They can live easily up to 150 years.
Wow.
What they do is they invest heavily in their eggs. The females will develop their eggs over 6 to 8 months. And all that time, they're adding more and more rich omega-3 fatty acid-rich, vitamins-rich, amino acid-rich baby formula for that baby sturgeon, when it's hatched, to live off of for the first few weeks of its life. Just like baby formula now is good for development of little kids' brains and bodies, just the same way it is for sturgeon eggs now.
Now, for those of you out there listening who, like me, want to be able to imagine all of this, let me paint a picture for you. The baby sturgeon eggs are deposited in the riverbed during spawning season. This takes place in a freshwater river that the sturgeon have migrated to from the ocean. Now, the female sturgeon can deposit about 1 million eggs at one time. And then the male sturgeons swim over that area and fertilize them. Well, not all of them, just the lucky ones that the sperm attaches to. Once the babies hatch into larvae, they feed on a yolk sac that's attached to their bellies, filled with all the nutrients that George has been talking about. After the yolk sac is absorbed, and that takes about 12 days, depending on the temperature of the water, the larvae, the tiny baby sturgeons, come out from between or behind the rocks where they're hiding, and they're off to their next stage of development, and then to find food on their own. We know that other fish, of course, produce eggs, roe, salmon, paddlefish, for example. George, what makes the sturgeon roe the most extraordinary?
From a biological standpoint, why sturgeon roe are special is because the sturgeon is investing a lot of energy and nutrition into the egg for their young to live off.
Okay.
But what makes sturgeon roe special to people and to humans across history and into nowadays is that sturgeon have always been seen as the regal fish of the river in Mesopotamia, but also in Europe and China, all over the world. And sturgeon are present all over the Northern Hemisphere. So in North America, Europe, Central Asia, and Eastern Asia, you'll find sturgeons. And they are extremely abundant in normal circumstances. So the analogy to think of is like cod, where back in the day, before industrial fishing took place, you know, the myths were, the saying was, you could walk across, you know, the Connecticut River on the backs of some of these fish off of salmon or cod. And it's only after the advent of industrial fishing that, you know, their numbers have dwindled. Well, sturgeon are the same way. Sturgeon are an abundant animal. You don't have to dive in the water and look around to see a sturgeon. If you're just standing on the banks of the river, say the Volga River in southern Russia, when it's spawning season, you will see the backs of thousands and countless thousands of sturgeon going upriver. Sturgeon have always been regal because not just of how their abundance, but how big they are. The beluga sturgeon, which is the biggest of them all, can get up to 26 feet long.
Wow.
When they're full size at 100 years old, they are as big as, if not bigger than, great white sharks. But what makes caviar, specifically the sturgeon roe, special, not just the fish and its grandeur, but the specialness of the roe. So the taste of roe from sturgeon is very buttery. The size of the eggs in comparison to other fish eggs are very big. We're talking 2 millimeters to 4 millimeters in diameter, which doesn't sound very big until you hold it in your hand and you remember that most fish eggs are microscopic. The other thing that makes them special, arguably the most special, because there's other fish eggs that taste good, is their color. Is that sturgeon eggs are usually black or amber colored, but the special ones, like albino ones, but also just older sturgeons, can have golden colored eggs. So if you're a king from, you know, the medieval times, and somebody brings a fish to your banquet and they cut it open and 20, 50 pounds of golden colored, delicious, buttery eggs come out, it's no wonder that the sturgeon became a symbol of luxury.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So it's not just the size. I mean, I think I read that the largest sturgeon ever documented weighed in at almost 3,500 pounds. Unbelievable. But it's these magical eggs that are produced by the female sturgeon. So lots of reasons why you might use the term regal. But let's talk about the flavor profile for a moment. With all the different species of sturgeon, how does the flavor profile of the roe vary from one specific fish to another?
So just like salmon or tuna, the species makes a big difference, right? there's a bunch of different tunas. The skipjack tuna is the one that you have in the can at the grocery store. And then there's the bluefin tuna, which its belly is, you know, hundreds of dollars just to sit at the table at a fancy Japanese restaurant in Tokyo. Where with caviar, it's the same way. So there are lots of sturgeon all over the world. There was Atlantic sturgeon and white sturgeon from the Northern Rockies. Those ones have a briny flavor in the beginning, and then they have a nice buttery finish. And then there are the ones from the Caspian Sea in between Russia and Iran, which have a deep, intense buttery flavor with notes of nuttiness, of sweetness, of sometimes lemoniness. All sturgeons have this buttery aspect. Usually it's on the aftertaste is extremely buttery, but the beginning of it, it has a huge range in variety and nuance, and that's based off of the species.
So going way back, George, was caviar always salted, processed before it was consumed?
When humans discovered salt and its properties for preservation was deep into prehistory. Humans started using salt, you know, kind of on an industrial level around 6000 BC. They realized that they could preserve food with salt. Any food that they wanted to keep for a long period of time, and whether that be a nomadic moving band of humans, like were very present in Eastern Europe, they needed to salt things in order to keep them for a long period of time. There's no refrigeration. So if you were just on the banks of the Volga River and you caught a bunch of sturgeon, you didn't need any salt unless you wanted some for taste. But if you were traveling or you were trying to trade in the fish row, that's when you needed salt. There is, even nowadays, a wide range in the amount of salt that you put on caviar, whether it is a ton of salt because you want it to last a really long time. Sometimes nowadays people will pasteurize caviar to make it shelf stable. You don't have to refrigerate or freeze it. But on the opposite side of the spectrum, a lot of caviar that was earmarked for royalty in Iran, for instance, would be salted extremely lightly because they knew exactly where this caviar was going to go. It was going to get to the Shah's palace within 2 days of being harvested. There's a bit of processing that goes on. You don't just pull it out of the fish and start eating it.
Another quick side note here, in terms of processing, the fish eggs are extracted from the ovaries of the sturgeons. The eggs then get separated from the membrane, and they're washed so that all the impurities and natural oils are taken out. Then they're ready to be cured with salt. So I asked George how much salt would typically be used in the curing process.
Anywhere from 5%, sometimes 10% salt, all the way down to 2% salt. So if you knew it was going to the Shah, you would just put a sprinkling of salt on there. The downside is it better get there on time or else it's going to spoil in hours.
Yeah, spoiled caviar is probably not going to go down too well with the Shah.
Yeah, some people will say, like, how weird is it that people decided to catch a fish and, you know, put salt on its eggs and eat it. Isn't that weird? Isn't that barbaric? And I laugh because I say, no, it's not. Like, humans, everybody loves eggs. Everybody loves eggs, whether it's from a chicken or it's from a fish. They are some of the most delicious and nutritious parts of the animal. Humans have known this forever, and salting things makes it taste better because your brain knows that it's safer to eat if it's salted. Yeah, so some people like a brinier caviar egg. Some people like a much less salty egg. For instance, when my mom came in to the market and I, you know, gave her the nice taste test of, you know, a few of our best ones, I asked her which one was her favorite. Was it the one from Italy? Was it the, you know, the Royal Etc.? She said, no, I really liked the first one you gave me, the white sturgeon. And I said, really? Like, that one's, you know, that's the cheapest one on the board. How come you like that one? And you know what she said? She's like, I liked it because it was extra briny. My family grew up going to Cape May and southern New Jersey and those beautiful beaches. And, you know, not only blue crab, but mid-Atlantic oysters were one of our favorite things. And unlike Maine oysters, which are deep buttery flavors, you know, sometimes near rivers, so they have a low salinity, it's extra briny. The brinier, the better. My mom would always say, I want my oysters to taste like I'm body surfing with my mouth open. And it's the same went with caviar, where, you know, it's up to your palate, right? There is, you know, the most esteemed or famous caviars in the world out there. But if it doesn't work for your palate, it's not the right one.
Very much like oysters in that sense. Bring on the brine, saltier the better. We talked about caviar's nutritional value. It's known to be high in omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin B12, selenium, and other nutrients that are really good for you. But there were some other qualities that were given to caviar, right? Over the years, over the centuries, almost mystical qualities that were attributed to eating caviar.
Historically speaking, the perceived benefits of eating caviar can pretty much be boiled down to two things. One is that food is medicine, right? The Persians, who were the first ones to make caviar, salted sturgeon roe, into a delicacy, believed not just that it tasted good, but that it had serious medicinal benefits that you wanted your king to take in from their food. So they believed that sturgeon roe, which they called caviar, as in the cake of strength, cake of power, that these effects included increased vitality, strength, youthfulness, increased libido, all things that you want your monarch to get from in their food, right? What's the most important thing that in a king's priority list is to make an heir. So, you know, if they have something that makes their libido go up, an aphrodisiac, it has extreme value to them. But to the Persians, it was medicine. But monarchs all across Europe and Asia had access to these sturgeons, and they saw its status as the monarch of the river, the biggest, most, you know, mystical, powerful fish of the river, that you are what you eat. If you eat the monarch of the river, you can take in those properties yourself. So that's really the essence of why not just the Persians, but the Chinese and the Greeks and the Romans and up into medieval times, they all had this. It transcended its culinary value. It was something that you wanted to instill in yourself through eating.
So, George, you go back far enough, and it wasn't just the royal class. It wasn't just those folks enjoying caviar, because the rivers were full of sturgeon. The folks outside the walls of the kingdom, the common folk, if you will, they were eating sturgeon and were enjoying the roe, the fish eggs. They would also eat the meat of the fish, right? As well as make soup from the bones. And fish eggs were just a part of that meal.
Some people have said to me, is it true that caviar was peasant food? And I push back on that, because when I think of peasant food, I think of gruel or, you know, porridge, something that's not just not tasty, but low in nutrition. Where I think the better word to think of what caviar was historically is as a staple, a food staple for a region. So it was something that used to be enjoyed by all classes of Eastern European and Central Asian society. The best analogy that I could come up with was quinoa. So if anybody knows the recent history of quinoa, is that it was a Peruvian, South American staple that community depended on it. And only recently, when the global economy found out about its taste and nutritional value, did it all of a sudden get completely exported and only exported across the world and no longer available to the people who used to depend on it. Caviar is an extremely similar situation, where the kings were enjoying it, but just like you said, so were all of the common folk.
There's also a religious aspect to the consumption of caviar in many parts of the world, correct?
Central Asia, Russia, is predominantly Muslim or predominantly Orthodox Christian. And both of those communities have restrictions on what food you can eat and when. Muslims believed, just like the Jewish religion, that there were animals that were clean and there were animals that were dirty. Sturgeon fell into the dirty category because they don't have scales, or they lose their scales at an early age. But it was, since it was such a profoundly important animal, the Muslims made an exception. And with Orthodox Christians, there is a large time around Lent for fasting. You're not allowed meat. Your diet is extremely restricted in a religious context. But caviar was an exception to that rule. You could eat caviar during those holy days of fasting. And it makes a lot of sense in that Christianity has a lot to do with rivers. And that's, you know, whether your baptism or, you know, the bounty of the sea in, you know, terms of fish and bread was something that Jesus was capable of, you know, performing miracles with. Fish was always an exception for fasting rules. It became a holiday, a Christian holiday specialty for many parts of the world.
That's interesting. I think, you know, oysters back in the 17th, 18th, into the 19th century were being sold on the streets of New York City, for example, out of carts, you know, for pennies. They were being enjoyed by all classes of people, rich, poor, you know, up and down. And they were plenty good for you, as they still are today. Now we're in the process of trying to rebuild oyster stocks all along the coast, especially in Maine. But they used to be so plentiful that they filled the bays, the rivers, and you could walk out and grab them, you know, with your hands. So with caviar, along comes Ivan the Terrible in the mid-16th century, Russia. And this guy loves caviar, right? Caviar fresh from the Caspian Sea. So he gets a reputation for serving it to his fellow aristocracy. George, was there a perception change, do you think, that suddenly made caviar the food only for the royalty?
First, I have to say is that the history of caviar is very hazy in specifics, but it's rich in generalities. Salted roe could be something you could trace back to way into prehistory. And then the Persians came in and they realized it was a really special thing, but thought of it as medicine. It was the Russians who took it out of the, it's special because of its medicinal purposes, and took it into the realm of it's special because of its lavish decadence. It became a staple of luxury with the Russian nobility. So even though it was an abundant food staple at the time, it wasn't necessarily overfished in the, you know, 15th century, 16th century, there were properties about it that were extremely special. As we described, it has golden color many times, but also these kings and nobilities, they're hosting banquets. They're hosting emissaries and nobles from other parts of Europe. You know, this time period around the Renaissance, there was a lot of trade. The Silk Road was in huge action. So these luxury goods are being traded and introduced all over the world. So think silk, porcelain, luxury foods, and caviar was absolutely one of them. Even though sturgeons existed all over Europe and Asia, it was only really the Russian, the Caspian Sea sturgeon, that were the most delicious and the most decadent and the most beautiful.
So what is it about the Caspian Sea that makes these sturgeon eggs so special?
The reason is a fewfold, and it's one of those places in the world where cuisine and geography really just fall perfectly into place. What I mean by that is that sturgeon are found all over the world. Why the Caspian Sea is special is because they have the biggest sturgeon of them all. I'm speaking about the beluga sturgeon specifically. The other thing that makes them special is that the salt, which is the other side of the, you know, salted roe recipe of caviar, some of the best salt in the world is found in the flats of the northern Caspian Sea. So this mighty river, the Volga River, deposits all this salt into what is arguably a great lake. So the Volga River will deposit all of this salt for millions of years, and its qualities are just this really fine, powdery, like granulated, powdered salt that is perfect for brining caviar. So what you have is the intersection of the biggest sturgeon, which have the biggest eggs, and the best salt for curing them. So that's why the Caspian Sea is so perfect for caviar is because it has the best of both the ingredients you need.
George, I'm guessing there are very few places on the planet that have this unique combination of river water, fresh water, and the saline from an ancient ocean.
Exactly. Some have great salt, some have great sturgeon, but only the Caspian Sea has both. So when people visited Russia and visited Peter the Great's court, or Ivan the Terrible's court, I'm sure I'd want to hang out with Peter the Great a little bit more than Ivan the Terrible, but yeah, both of them had caviar available and it blew people away. And they would go home and realize, oh, wow, you know, in the rivers of Burgundy or the rivers of Britain or rivers of Germany, there were these sturgeons. We should go catch them at our river too. So they weren't as good. They were usually a little bit briny, weren't necessarily as big or as pretty. But all of a sudden, with the rise of the Russian nobilities, after they finally kicked the Mongols out, they spread the word about caviar and it became extremely popular. And it was only after its popularity started skyrising that we as humans started getting the ability to overfish them.
Yeah. And along comes the Russian Revolution and nobility looks around and says, kids, honey, it's time to pack up the gowns and don't forget the caviar because we're going to Europe. In fact, I think we're going to go to Paris. And suddenly, Paris in the teens and 20s, right? You have this explosion. It's champagne wishes and caviar dreams. I mean, it becomes the thing. And a lot of it had to do with this exodus of the nobles and royals who were booted out of Russia, went to Germany, to France. And, you know, they carried these little tins with them, right? It was like, we're not leaving the good stuff.
Yeah. It is ironic when you think about the history of France that, you know, emigres from a noble class would retreat to Paris. You know, it wasn't too long before that, you know, it was the exact opposite way around. But what you have to remember is that the term lingua franca goes back to that French was the second language of many of these nobles all across Europe. That was the language that they spoke to in their own circles. So it makes perfect sense that when the Bolshevik Revolution started and the white emigres fled to Western Europe, the first place they're going to go to is Paris. Not just because they speak the language, but because it was the capital of culture, of sophistication. If you were a noble, you didn't want to go to a backwater.
Oh, no way.
The Roaring Twenties was when caviar really started skyrocketing because the folks, you know, fleeing that revolution had brought their delicacies and style of banquets to the Western world.
There's a shop in New York right near Chelsea Market, Petrosian Caviar, right? That name comes up a lot when you're researching caviar. That's the Petrosian brothers, correct? From Armenia. They were major exporters in Paris in the early days.
One of the earliest, absolutely. Yes, those Armenian brothers brought the know-how and the network of how do we get Russian caviar, Persian caviar to France. This thing, you know, in 1920, refrigeration is very young. So it is not easy to get a specialty, easily spoilable food from the Caspian Sea to France. That took a lot of know-how and it took knowing the right people. That's why Petrosian became the leader, is because they had those connections and they had the know-how in order to get the caviar safely there. Because one of the things that can happen is spoiled caviar will hurt you. It's very dangerous to eat. There are serious bacteria that if you don't get your caviar from a trusted, safe source, you know, it could harm you. That's why those guys, the Petrosian brothers, became famous, is because they were at the right place at the right time with the right know-how.
Right. Seriously. Okay. We've already gone down, I'm going to say, happily gone down the proverbial caviar rabbit hole, which is fine, but we do need to go back. We need to understand a bit about your background, George, where you grew up, and because we're doing a podcast called Tales of the Sea, I always like to ask, what's your first memory of the sea?
My first memory of the sea is body surfing with my grandfather in Cape May, New Jersey, when I was a little kid. So my grandparents would take us to the beach, to the Jersey Shore, every August, and we would have a great time building sandcastles and body surfing and eating blue crabs and just really having a great time. So the sea to me was something to play in. It was something that provided great food. But most of all, for me specifically, it provided great stories. And of one topic in particular was of most fascination to me, and that was sharks.
Ah, interesting.
The Jersey Shore back, 100 years ago, became famous as a hotbed for shark attacks. Many people will know that the book and then the movie Jaws was made after a string of shark attacks that set terror in the hearts of everyone on the Jersey Shore, because in one summer, like 5 people were killed by arguably 1 or 2 sharks, one of them going all the way up into the estuaries and, killing a kid miles away from the shoreline. Sharks, any kid with a library card is going to go straight to the, sharks and Bigfoot aisle of the library. And I sure did. So I was always fascinated with sharks, and playing in the ocean was long after that those two things combined. And I got the opportunity to do scuba dive with sharks for many years.
Well, that we're going to definitely hold for an episode on sharks, which I would love to do. I've been researching sharks. Fascinating subject. Okay, back to growing up. I'm interested, too, in influential people in your life, George, and also, particular seminal moments. I sometimes use the phrase when the hook was set and you were, thinking this is going to be my life. I'm going to be connected to the sea one way or another. I'm going to figure it out. This is going to be my career, and I'm not letting go of this.
For me, that moment was getting an internship when I was at University of Vermont to work with open ocean, sustainable aquaculture in Hawaii. I knew I was going to be involved somehow with animals. My whole life, I had the opportunity to hunt and fish with my dad. TV shows like Shark Week and Steve Irwin, the Crocodile Hunter, always fascinated me.
Of course.
My education was at University of Vermont, and I went to the natural resource school called the Rubenstein School, and I majored in food sustainability. When I called my parents and gave them the classic, I don't know what I want to do when I grow up phone call, my stepmom, who has worked in sustainable seafood for many years in New York City, told me, I just went to the Boston Seafood Show and I heard these guys talking about sustainable aquaculture in Hawaii, where your aunt and uncle live on the Big Island. They're called Kampachi Farms, now called Ocean Era. I don't really know him that well, but the guy's name is Neil Sims. Why don't you give him a call? See if he'll give you a job. And I said, okay.
There you go. So how did that work out?
After many, many unrequited emails saying, hire me, hire me, hire me, hire me, hire me to this company in Hawaii, they finally said, if you agree to stop emailing us, we'll give you an unpaid internship for the summer. How's that sound? I said, deal. In between my junior and senior year of college at University of Vermont, I spent the summer working with Kampachi Farms, and we were working with sustainable aquaculture feed research, finding new ways to find the protein and oils that fish need to grow. Normally, those proteins and oils come from wild fish meal and fish oil. But we found that if you use terrestrial plant proteins and microalgae oils, that you can actually provide fish in aquaculture settings with the nutrition that they need in order to grow.
Really?
The reason that those technologies aren't in use now is because they're not commercially competitive against the price of wild fish protein and oils. So wild bait fish are still plentiful enough for the time being that they are still out competing terrestrial or alternative sourced diets.
Your mention of the term aquaculture provides a great segue into sustainable caviar production and the facts that folks thought that the oceans were inexhaustible. The old saying goes that there's more fish in the sea. Well, that was blown up back in the 70s when all of a sudden we could harvest fish faster than they could replenish themselves in the wild, right?
And now all of a sudden In the last few decades, aquaculture has taken 50% or more of the market share of supply for seafood across the world. And nothing is more true for that sentence than sturgeon. They take so long to replenish themselves in the wild. They take up to 20 years just to reach maturity, not end of life, but just puberty, that they can't replace themselves when they're the most coveted fish in the world. It was that experience in Hawaii, working with this team of dedicated young people that were just a few years older than me, who were dedicated to finding ways that we can feed ourselves without bankrupting the ocean, that I realized I'm not going to be a skier. I'm going to be an aquaculturist, because my background was in food sustainability. And now all of a sudden I found a way that I could have a mission to educate and promote sustainable aquaculture for people who just think, oh, farmed fish is bad for you and wild fish is good. And it's so much more nuanced than that. And we need more education to let people know that there are better ways to differentiate what's good and bad.
Helping to extend, the kind of awareness of aquaculture, of taking care of the seas, because there's so much misinformation out there about the efficacy and quality of farm fish, for example. As you know, things have changed dramatically in the industry. But are people even aware of the things that have gone on, of the recent developments?
Many people aren't. Many people say, it's only wild fish and for me, and all farmed fish is bad. So it's my job to tell them that it's not that simple. There are good farms and there's bad farms, and there's good wild caught and there's bad wild caught. And for caviar specifically, there's only good farmed caviar. All wild caviar production became illegal in the end of the 90s and early 2000s. And it was because the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 90s, and their programs of regulating the caviar trade completely vanished. And the 90s were a smash and grab for poaching and illicit caviar production and smuggling that brought these sturgeons to the brink of extinction.
Wow.
And it was the CITES agreement, the Committee of International Trade of Endangered Species, Flora and Fauna, that agreed we need to stop. We need to let these fish repopulate and replenish themselves. There's too much going on. There's too many dams. There's too much pollution. There's too much poaching for them to survive. They're going to be gone in a matter of years if we don't stop. And 181 countries signed that agreement. So now, as of 2006, all caviar is farm-raised to be legal.
Just a quick side note here. Since the CITES agreement George mentioned in 2006, China has become the world's largest producer of farm-raised sturgeon, followed by Russia, Armenia, and Italy. Italy, in fact, being the top producer of caviar in the European region. But closer to home, as George and I both live on beautiful Casco Bay here in Portland, Maine, I was curious, George, have you ever seen a sturgeon in these waters?
I've had an Atlantic sturgeon jump like Free Willy over my surfboard at Higgins Beach. Almost took my head off.
I've heard stories of sturgeon that have jumped out of the water and landed smack on the bow of a boat.
Yeah, they love to jump. They're beautiful animals. Yeah,
to clean themselves off, apparently, as they live on the bottom.
Right. It's like dogs that like to rub their bellies on everything they can. Same thing.
But you don't see a lot of caviar coming out of Maine, and I assume there's a good reason for that.
In the 1800s and 1900s, just like you were saying, how oysters were, on every street corner in New York City, so was Atlantic caviar.
Which means sturgeon were traveling up the rivers on the East Coast to spawn.
In vast numbers. We wiped them out so completely that we wiped out the memory. Nobody even remembers that caviar used to be in every river in North America, because we wiped them out so conclusively. We don't remember that bison used to travel all over the Central Plains. Nobody's even heard of a passenger pigeon, which was the most populous animal on Earth, because we obliterated them in a 50-year period for fun.
Yeah, it's a dark history we humans share when it comes to extinction or near extinction of species.
But there is a good side, and that is that the technology that nearly wiped out wild fish is now giving them a second chance at life in the form of sustainable aquaculture.
And here's where I think it gets really interesting. Sturgeons, as we know, are anadromous, meaning that they spend most of their lives in saltwater, only returning then to freshwater to spawn. Typically, it takes between 10 and 20 years for a sturgeon to reach maturity, as you've said. And even then, spawning cycles can be from, I think, 1 to 5 years. So reproducing the perfect conditions for raising sturgeon in an aquaculture environment, a farm, seems just a mind-boggling task to me.
So humans have been farming livestock like cattle, chickens, sheep, pigs for 10,000 years. Nowadays, because all of those animals have evolved and adapted to life and domestication, it seems really easy. But what you don't realize is that it took ages for humans to figure out how to raise these animals and which ones you can raise and which ones you can't raise.
Great point.
So the Fertile Crescent of Mesopotamia in Egypt was a special place because the humans there were just surrounded by animals that were perfect for domestication, or plants and animals, right? So you had your wheat and barley was right there, and you had your cattle and pigs and sheep right there too. That's why civilization started there. But when you realize we've only been farming fish on a large scale for the last 70, 80 years, with few exceptions. The Hawaiians famously were doing fish ponds, and so were the Chinese. But in the industrial world, aquaculture is extremely young. It's in its infancy. It really is no wonder to me that aquaculture made a bad name for itself, because it was in its infancy. And it was in a time period of the 70s and 80s when regulation was lax. The first thing we tried farming was salmon, because it was the most coveted animal. It was the most in demand, and it made a really nasty name for aquaculture. And it's these dirty farms. Your question, how can we possibly raise an animal as mysterious as a sturgeon and get a product as remarkable as caviar out of a process that's so new? The answer is you got to do it really carefully.
I should think so.
When you think about how it's not just one farm figuring out everything, there is so much institutional knowledge that has been passed down by universities like UC Davis, the University of Ghent in Belgium, who are responsible for many of the world's innovations in aquaculture, that it's one step at a time you figure out how to take care of these animals in captivity. Sturgeon farming started in a research sense in the 1970s, when peak caviar production hit and we could see that we were starting to get less and less every year out of the wild. People said we need to start figuring out how to farm the white sturgeon in California, but also the Russian sturgeons as well. Over the last 50 years, innovations come slowly. Understanding comes slowly. Knowledge comes slowly, but it comes surely. About the end of the 80s was when the first successful commercial caviar farms started, famously in Italy, in Poland, and in the United States. Recently, China has become the number one producer of farmed caviar, with one farm being responsible for 65% of the world's caviar production.
Wow.
Some people think, oh, they must be doing it cheaply and poorly, but the opposite is true. Chinese caviar is extremely high quality. The fact of the matter is that we have gotten very good at raising fish in captivity where welfare is the priority. Sturgeon have the ability to pick and choose when they want to spawn. So not only do you have to raise these animals to the lifespan it takes to getting pregnant and then having your child get to college.
That's a great way to look at it.
But you also have to provide them with an environment, with water quality, with food quality. That's the, ironically, is treating them like kings. There is no such thing as a stressed out caviar producing sturgeon. If they're stressed, they won't make eggs. The New York Times just came out with an article about a caviar farm that's very famous for extremely good caviar in northern Israel called Galilee Farms. They wrote an article called Sturgeons and Shrapnel. This farm is located in the Golan Heights, tucked in between the border of Lebanon and Syria. Errant missiles and invading armies have all made being on this farm extremely dangerous. And all but three employees had fled. And the remaining three said, "These sturgeons are too precious to us. It's not just about making the caviar, but if we don't take care of these animals every single day and provide them with the right conditions, they'll die." It's the perfect example of showing that that animal welfare is the number one priority to sturgeon farmers, because if these animals are stressed, they will not make eggs.
George, we know that with scarcity comes fraud. I mean, when something becomes completely scarce, somebody's always out there willing to make a buck or looking to make a buck and creating a knockoff. It's got to be particularly tough with caviar.
It is. So 30% of the world's caviar is illicit, whether that be knockoffs pretending to be true sturgeon caviar, or whether it is poached, smuggled wild sturgeon caviar from Russia or Iran and brought illegally to a different country. So there's a lot to look out for, because improperly processed wild caviar is extremely unhealthy to eat. You can have high levels of bacteria if it's not salted in time or if it reaches unsafe temperatures. But also, there's a lot of pollution in the Caspian Sea these days, not just from unregulated industry from the Soviet era, but famously underwater nuclear detonations took place in the Caspian Sea in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and was arguably one of the reasons why the sturgeon populations collapsed in the wild. So there's a lot of reasons right now to avoid black market caviar. People say to me when they come into the market all the time, "Your prices are pretty high. You know, I can get a kilo of beluga caviar from my guy in New York City." And what I tell them is, there's a couple hundred beluga sturgeons left in the wild. You really think that a guy, you know, in the back alley is going to give you one of the few tins left in the world for $100? No, it's a knockoff. It's fake. What is easier to fraudulently mislabel than a tin of fish eggs?
So what should the caviar shopper be aware of?
One of the famous ways you can tell that someone is trying to sell you fake illegal caviar is by saying things like, "It's black caviar," or "It's beluga," even though it doesn't say so on the tin. And they won't let you taste it before you try it.
Okay, so who are the watchdogs? Is the FDA or other state agencies on top of this issue?
In the United States, the Fish and Wildlife Service regulates caviar trade. But internationally, it's the Committee for the International Trade of Endangered Species, Flora and Fauna, called CITES. So every year they meet back up and come up with new ways of not just regulating legal and illegal caviar, but also how to repopulate wild populations of sturgeon across the world.
Well, I'm certainly glad to hear that. But let's get back to the culinary adventure with caviar. What's your favorite way to serve caviar, George?
So the traditional way is to have caviar on top of Bellini pancakes with creme fraiche. But to me, just like with maple syrup on your pancakes, it's never enough. You always need more caviar in order to overpower the spongy effect of the pancake.
Of course.
Now, back in the day, you know, when caviar was a penny, or, you know, if I had a yacht and I could afford a kilo of caviar for my pancakes, it wouldn't be a problem. But for us regular folks, the best way to enjoy caviar, in my opinion, is on other seafood.
Ah.
Whether that be oysters with sea urchin roe, known as uni.
Right.
Or on top of bluefin tuna belly. So we're getting pretty decadent here.
Wow. Right? Yeah, seriously.
But any type of sashimi, whether it's salmon or tuna or yellowtail or oysters or scallops, anything that would be delicious raw will be 10 times better if you put caviar on top.
Ooh, yeah.
I like to say that it's flavor magnification.
Right, right.
You know, it's the The total when caviar is involved is greater than the sum of the parts.
No question.
Now, recently, with the greater availability of cheaper caviar, there has been a really popular trend for low versus high cuisine. Famously, potato chips with creme fraiche and caviar on top.
Oh, wow.
There is a historical through line here, and that's that caviar and potatoes have a very long history.
Sure.
So it does have some semblance of validity to put it on a potato chip, whether it's a Pringle or some Ruffles. I think that's a bit far. There are really nice kettle chips that are not overly salted or overly flavored that would go really, really well. I can attest that to some California white sturgeon or some Idaho Springs Snake River sturgeon caviar with on top of a potato chip with some creme fraiche is awesome. Now, if I had Ocetra caviar or Beluga, there's no way in hell, you know, the ghost of Peter the Great would come and smack me in the back of the head if you put that on a potato chip. So if you've really got the good stuff, the best way to have it is with a mother of pearl spoon and a glass of champagne with somebody you love on anniversary or on New Year's Eve on a special occasion. It's never meant to be something you eat every day. Even when it was a penny, it was something special.
I look forward to having a special day or two in the days ahead, George. Last question. Do you have a favorite tale of the sea? A book or a poem, a song, a story, or something that you come back to time and again because it takes you to a special place?
I do. It's a quote, and who knows who said it. I don't know. It might have been Abraham Lincoln or Albert Einstein, but the quote is this. The cure for anything is seawater, whether it's sweat, tears, or the sea.
Ah, the magic of salt water. There's nothing quite like it.
To me, I realized it when, after a stressful day of working on a fish farm or scuba diving, taking care of my offshore fish, I would jump in the ocean and do some body surfing on my way home. It was the ocean. It was playing in the ocean the way I used to with my grandparents that always just cured whatever it was ailing me that day.
Yeah, that's great. And if I'm not mistaken, George, that quote is attributed, I believe, to Karen Blixen. Isaac Dennison was one of her pen names. I'm going to call it. That's a wrap. Thank you so much for your time. You've been extremely generous. I can't thank you enough. I look forward to seeing you down at Brown Trading.
It was a pleasure, Mark. Thanks so much for having me.
That ends this episode of Tales of the Sea. If you enjoyed this episode, please tell a friend or two. Special thanks to my guest, George Faison of Brown Trading Company here in Maine, for sharing his passion for and knowledge of caviar. This episode was produced at Munjoy Studios in Portland, Maine. As always, special thanks to my producer, Jules Selbo. And remember, you'll find this podcast, Tales of the Sea, wherever you stream your favorite podcasts. I thought I might end with the last few lines of one of my favorite Noel Coward songs titled, Alice is at It Again.
Our dear old white-headed mother, wistfully sipping champagne, said we've spoiled our child, spared the rod, open up the caviar and say thank God, we've got no cause to complain. Alice is at it again.
I'm Mark Winkworth. Thanks for listening.